Hello, everyone. In the Buddhist model of things, with a model, remember, a model is not reality. What we are really trying to describe is this, like what it is to be a human being. In order to understand this confusing mass of bodily feelings and thoughts and emotions and history and organs and different things, in order to understand this, we have to make some kind of model. Buddhism uses certain models, and these models are different with some other traditions, and also different between Buddhist traditions. So we should always understand these teachings as not being actual reality, not being totally, this is the truth, like a received truth. Like in Christianity, you have the word of God, and that has to be true, and he's put his word down into a book. He wrote a book and he gave you the book, and now your job is to believe it. And for many of us, that's exactly the kind of thinking and tradition that we wanted to get away from. When we look at the teachings as models, we see, okay, it's just a way of describing this in order to get some kind of handle on things. For example, you know, Freud said that a human being is three levels of consciousness, right? There's the conscious mind, the preconscious, and the unconscious. And each of these had a role within his teaching. Is there really a conscious, a preconscious, and an unconscious? Can you go into the brain and get to the conscious part of the mind or get to the unconscious and see it? Probably not. There's some debate about this, but probably not. There are other ways to understand a human being. I like that one. There are three kinds of human beings in the world. Those who understand maths and those who don't. So that's another model. That's a way to split up the world's population. The model that we use in Buddhism is there is a thing that we call the unconditioned. And this word unconditioned comes from the word asankhata dhamma. Now asankhata means something that's put together and built or comprised of parts. So asankhata means something that is not built, does not comprise of parts. So all your sankhata or sankhara, these two words are often used together or interchangeably. Asankhata or sankhara means something that's built up out of parts. Anything that is thus built is going to change and is going to decay. So we can look at something like a wagon. We might update it to a Toyota, but let's keep it simple. Where in the wagon is the wagon? Is there really a wagon or isn't there? In the wagon, you have the wheels, you have the bed, you have the sides, you have the axle. You take any one of these parts away and it's not going to operate as a wagon anymore. Furthermore, all of these parts are not going to be in operation together for that long. They have a limit to their lifespan. So we can say, in some respects, that there is no wagon. That doesn't mean to say that the wagon isn't actually there. It just means to say that within this collection of parts, we can't find a thing that is the wagon. But the teaching gets a bit sharper than that, because for there to be a wagon, the wagon only appears as an experience. Now you may question, you may wonder if a wagon actually exists outside while you're not looking at it, while you're not interacting with it. But the fact is that when you turn your attention inwards and you're looking at the actual mind, what you find is an experience arises, lasts for a very short period of time, and then will filter away. And that time that experience arises lasts only for seconds. So, when we say that the wagon is put together, on the internal scale, we can say, well, whether or not a wagon externally exists in reality or not is another question. People can debate that all they like. But internally, when I look at the actual experience, what I have is it comes up as an experience, and then it will die, will disappear. And to a meditator, this is both real and important. Because as you wander around through life, you have a world full of these constructed ideas. There's a wagon, there's your house, there's your age, there's your gender, there's your nationality, there are your beliefs, all kinds of ways that you like to identify yourself. And this is in our constructed world. And we must have these kind of constructs, these kind of ideas, in order to get around. So, because we operate like this most of the time throughout the world, this is our model for how the world works. And for most of us then, all this world, in where we have all our models or constructs, kind of sucks, right? Is the world a great place or isn't it? Well, depends on, you know, your outlook, doesn't it? If yesterday you lost your visa and tomorrow you have to leave Thailand and you've got to leave all your stuff behind and you don't know who's going to feed your cat, then the world kind of sucks, right? If somebody comes along and says to you, you're an idiot, on that day, you're going to be pretty angry, right? Don't call me an idiot. The world sucks. Now I'm going to make your world suck by being angry at you and calling you a name straight back. If, on the other hand, instead of losing your visa and having to leave Thailand tomorrow, you win the pools. We used to call pools lottery, right? In England, we call it the pools, but you win the lottery. Now you've got $10 million. How do you feel now? Somebody comes along and calls you an idiot now, what's your reaction? Yes, but I'm a rich idiot. So, whether the world is a good or a bad place depends very much on your internal makeup, which changes from moment to moment. Right? So, these ideas and these people that say the world's such a terrible place, I don't really buy into. And then there's these people who wander around, oh, everything's beautiful, everybody's nice, everything happens for a reason, God loves us. I certainly don't buy into that one either. Do you know Calvin and Hobbes cartoon? Hobbes, the tiger, the toy tiger, says to Calvin, who's a six-year-old boy, he's been a six-year-old boy for 25 years, have you realized that? The tiger says to Calvin, do you believe in God? And Calvin goes like this, He said, well, somebody's out to get me. That's kind of my view on the world. Is there a God? Well, somebody's causing me trouble. The world of our constructed ideas, is it real or is it not real? Is it good or is it bad? It depends very much upon you. But for most people, we think that it needs some improvement. And right now in Thailand, we have a military government who have decided that Thailand needs improvement, and they're setting out to try and improve, you know, the way Thailand works. And by improving everything, they will return happiness to the people. One of my favorite ways to entertain myself on my long taxi rides that I seem to be in every day is I ask the taxi driver, has the government returned happiness to you yet? And and I get an interesting range of opinions, and that keeps me entertained for, you know, my long taxi rides. Well, whether the world really does exist out there or not, you know, I do value and appreciate people who are willing to work in the world in that way, who do want to try and make the world into a better place. I'm not sure that I'm one of them. I'm not volunteering for government to be prime minister. I saw this great graph that it was like when you're 15 years old, you think that you know all the answers, and if you were the president of the country, everything would be fine. And then by the time you get to like 40, you realize, actually, I can't really do anything, and it just sucks anyway. And then by the time you get to 70, you're back to thinking that if you were president of the country, you would solve all the problems in the world. If only they asked me, I'd tell them how it is. Well, all that, you know, I appreciate people who do that, who are willing to try and dabble in their areas of the world and make things better. But to a meditator, that's not our experience. We want to come back to what is actually real. And what's actually real is not there is a wagon outside and it's a good or a bad wagon, it's useful or not useful, I need to change it, or how do I use it? But that a wagon arises as an experience in my mind. And this we call a Dhamma. In the Abhidhamma, one part of Buddhism, we call this a Dhamma. A Dhamma arises, a moment of experiencing. Within that moment of experiencing, there are various components. If we talk about Suzuki, I like these Suzuki vans, the APV vans. I don't know if you know these. They're really quite small, but quite high, and there's three rows of seats. And I think every car should be like that. I mean, they're just so well designed. For the wheelbase length, they're shorter than a Toyota, but you've got three rows of seats. I mean, how fantastic is that? If I had a car, I wouldn't want a boot or a trunk. I would want to be able to have the entire car. These Suzuki vans are like that. I love them. So a moment of Suzuki vanness arises as an experience. Right? Within that experience, there are various components. There is my memory of what is a Suzuki van, my perceptions around it. This, by the way, is called the five khandhas. It's a particular model, particular teaching in Buddhism. So there is perceptions. First of all, there's a form, there's a physical form of the Suzuki van. Van slash car slash people carrier. You see how good they are. They're just like, you can do everything with them. So there is the physical form made out of metal, a certain size, certain shape, certain color. But even if I close my eyes, there is still a certain size, shape, physical color registering in my occipital lobe. So the sight of a van and the thought of the van visually actually operates the same areas in the back of your mind. And this has been tested a number of times. If you see a tiger and you just think of seeing a tiger, the same areas light up in the back of your brain here. This is where your vision goes. Your right eye goes to the left side, your left eye goes to the right side and appears on the back of your head here. And a few years ago, they had a really cool, such a cool experiment. I mean, I know some people here think I'm a bit of a geek. I'm not sure I agree, but this experiment was so cool. They put electrodes all over the back of the occipital lobe and measured the electrical activity. They also put people in front of YouTube and measured the activity at the back of the brain. And then, while monitoring the back of a person's brain, they recorded all those signals while the person was sleeping and then matched those signals up to the closest YouTube video that they could find. Very interesting. So basically you have a visual record of your dreams. Very interesting. How accurate it was, you know, for now is obviously very experimental. The point being that the form of the Suzuki van, the sight, which is the size, the color, the shape, is external, but is also represented internally. What else do we have in that moment of Suzuki van experience, Dhamma experience? You have liking or disliking, right? For me, I love it. I just love that thing. For other people, you might say, well, it's a three-cylinder motorized van with low gearing to take high loads. It's not fuel efficient, should have a hybrid motor and a battery, therefore you don't like it. It's not a Toyota Prius. Somebody else may have had an accident with one of these vans, you know, you may have turned around and had a seen it for 5 seconds before it hit you in the leg. And so now when you see a Suzuki van, you don't like it. I was always like that with Mercedes. My parents had this old then it was new. But I remember getting car sick in that Mercedes and being sick. And now every time I see one of those Mercedes, it's a negative perception of the old Mercedes. So you have liking or disliking, you have perceptions of it. What is it? What's it used for? You have the form of it. You also have your mind state. As mentioned earlier, the mind state that you have in the present moment will color how you interpret things. If you win the lottery, you interpret things in a nicer way. And you also have consciousness. Now, your consciousness arises with that Dhamma and it ceases with that Dhamma, according to Buddhism. Consciousness is not like a field. Here I am, I'm aware, and things come into my awareness and they go out of my awareness. That's not how it works in Buddhism. How it works in Buddhism is you come into contact with an object, visually, audibly, physically, and then you have a moment of experience, experiencing that object. That's consciousness arising with the thing that you are conscious of. So William James, the world's first great psychologist, he investigated this for a long time. It's in a very interesting document called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which I'm sure some people here have heard of, but I guarantee nobody here has read. I've tried reading it about 6 times, and his English is so bad that it just, this horrible academic Germanic kind of, you know, Germans used to write in very long sentences, you know, 100 years ago. I think they still do, but this is the way that he used to write. He was noting within psychology that you can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. What is consciousness when you're not conscious of something? So for every moment of experience, we can see we have these different components come together. Right now, I think of a Suzuki. If I mention something, can you see in your own mind the experience arise and pass away? Should we try it? I'm just going to throw up a couple of general objects and see what the experience is as you come into contact. You're coming into contact with the physical form, which in this case is the sound wave of my voice. Skytrain. There's an experience come up, and then you're like, what about the Skytrain? Right? Because you can only hold it there for a brief second, and then you're starting to dissect it and ask questions. How about a Buddha Rupa? Is there liking or disliking? Do you have perceptions around it? If you're Islamic and they have this idea of not making graven images, I mean, this is a terrible thing, right? If you're Indian Buddha Rupas are very ornate, and this is Thai ones are pretty bland, right, compared to Indian ones. The reason is the Thais used to make Buddha images out of lignite, which is very hard to make, cut details into. So their robes and the patterns were very simple on the lignite statues. I always have this thing about a stick. You know, one day I was walking through the temple with a stick and smart ass monk said to me, "Are you going to go and beat up some novices?" And then it was actually a piece of wood, and I walked on a bit further and I saw the building monk, and he looked immediately at my piece of wood and he said, "Are you making something?" Because I'd kind of taken the wood from the wood pile at the back of the temple. And then I walked on a bit further and there's a dog, which is a very vicious dog, and if you have something in your hand, it'll go for you because he feels threatened. That day there wasn't, but there was another dog who, if you had a stick in your hand, he'd come running up to you because he wants to play. It's the same stick. But everyone has a different perception. What is your perception of the thing? It's your karma. It's an easy way to understand the word karma. People get very confused with karma. If my car gets stolen, does that mean that I stole somebody's horse in a previous lifetime? Yeah. This kind of idea. Karma just means a habit. It means the way that you've interacted with something before will color your experience of it now. So for every Dharma that arises, every moment of experiencing, there are these components that all come together. Perceptions, the liking, the disliking, karma and the memory, the consciousness, the mind states that you're carrying with you. And this is a Dhamma. And the Dhamma has come up. As a meditator, when you look at your experience, everything is a Dhamma coming up, one after the other, after the other, after the other, after another. And suddenly you're living not in a stable world with a government and a visa and policies and my self-identity. Suddenly you're living in this very viciously effervescent world of things just like bouncing around from one side to another side to another side. It's craziness. It's a bit like looking at a TV screen from away, you know, from far away, and you just see the pictures of the story played out. But when you get close up, you see these millions of little tiny dots jumping around like crazy. So to the meditator, we start to get sick and tired of this. This instability of the mind. The mind just doesn't stop still, doesn't want to cooperate. So what can we do about that? Not very much. You can squish it down a bit. Okay, I'll concentrate on something. So you concentrate on my breathing. And after a while, all these little tiny dots on the screen start to organize themselves and just in-breath and out-breath, in-breath and out-breath. And you say, hey, this meditation business, this is quite good. This feels kind of smooth now. But then what happens is, of course, as you come out of concentration, you're back to exactly where you started from. So after a while, you get this feeling that you just want to get out of it altogether. Now, aside from these dhammas that are coming up and disappearing, which is the whole world, nothing you can touch, think of, feel, taste, smell, hear, that isn't just this effervescence. Components suddenly coming together in a moment of experience and then vanishing. Well, according to the enlightened people, there is something else. And this thing is called the asankata, or the unconditioned, which is what I started out by mentioning. And this asankata, unconditioned, if you're familiar with mystic Christianity, you'll also know it as the uncreated. And the uncreated is God, which is interesting, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So according to the Buddha, there is this unconditioned, like a background experience, into which everything arises and out of which everything ceases. But this particular source of light or awareness is always there. It doesn't grow old, doesn't change, doesn't die. Every other experience will arise, last for a while, change, and vanish. Everything. There's no exceptions. That's a teaching on impermanence, but impermanence doesn't mean, you know, like if I build a building in 1,000 years, it will have dismantled. You know, the Wat Damagaya stupa, Jedi, they said they built it to last 1,000 years. Only the best materials, so that no matter how long the world lasts, even if aliens come in 10,000 years, the last thing that they will see of a human civilization maybe is the Great Wall of China and Wat Damagaya. Then the aliens can restart the Damagaya lineage and take it back to their home planet. I think that's their reasoning. So the fact that stuff out there is going to arise and disappear, you know, that's not a very smart observation. This teaching of the Buddha, he said everything's impermanent. This is kind of how people take it. But it's not a new idea, right? It's plenty of Greek philosophers realized that everything changes. But to see everything changing in the mind, seeing everything to change experience by experience, or Dhamma arising and Dhamma dissipating, Dhamma arising, Dhamma dissipating. That is quite different. That's quite special. When you see this, it undermines your whole sense of self. Like, well, where am I in that effervescent thing? It's like getting up close to a TV screen and you see all the little pixels and like, where's Downton Abbey gone? I've never watched Downton Abbey. But do you know why I like Downton Abbey? When I meet Americans, like 5 years ago, they'd always hear my accent and say, oh my God, you sound like someone of Harry Potter. And now they say, oh my God, you sound like someone of Downton Abbey. So I think I've gone up in the world. I'm no longer a Harry Potter character. I'm a Downton Abbey Earl. That suits me a bit better. Get up close to the screen, Downton Abbey disappears. Right? It's not, where's it gone? So the same with the mind. When you're watching the mind in this way, your sense of self starts to dissipate. And the Buddha said, watching the impermanence of the mind will undermine the conceit, I am. Interesting. So, what happens then when all of these experiences stop? If you can stop the mind, if you can stop this effervescence of the mind, what happens? Remember, this is everything you can see, smell, taste, touch, feel. This is every Dhamma that arises with its perceptions and its memories and its mind states. What if you just stopped the whole thing? Is that even possible? One thing we know is you can't stop the jitta. The jitta, the mind, the knowing, that carries on the whole time. But the thing that you know, stuff that you know, that can stop. And what happens to a meditator then, as you are watching this process, you get this, they call nipitta. Nipitta means disenchantment. I love this word. That these pictures on the screen have enchanted you with their story. But when you've gone up close and you realize there's, you know, they're just little things firing, that whole story doesn't enchant you anymore. So this whole story, I am, it just doesn't enchant anymore. I need this, I want that. I'm beautiful, I'm rich, I'm clever, I'm educated. All this stuff, all this self-identity stuff, it's just gone. And you think, so nice to be free of my own ego. Now, I'm saying that because we all obviously have an ego. I have one too. Some egos are better than others, but we all have one. You know, the point is you can't operate without an ego. That's the thing. But just for that moment, just for that flash, it just, everything stopped. When everything stops, you get the hint or the glimpse of that asankhata dhamma. So one question that we get asked sometimes is, if all the things in the world are impermanent, what's left over? If all that stops, what's left over? Well, that asankhata dhamma, it's not correct to say it is something. If we say it is this, this, and this, we've just made it into another dhamma that's arisen. But that asankhata dhamma, according to the enlightened beings, is something that is there, is real. And when you touch upon it, you become enlightened. Ramana Maharshi, one of my favorite mystics, he wasn't a Buddhist. He actually described it as like a cinema screen, which in the 1950s in India, when he was teaching, can you imagine that a big cinema screen with a movie about foreign places? Can you imagine that to Indians who, you know, probably wouldn't even have electricity for the next 30 years, and suddenly they see this enormous image of these glamorous Humphrey Bogart and, you know, the Maltese Falcon. And can you imagine that, just the magic show that would have been? So Ramana Maharshi is teaching at this time, and he says, the mind is exactly like those cinema screens, enchanting you with this story. But behind that story, you've forgotten. that the screen on which it's played never changes. It only appears that it changes. Said in the same way, there is this enlightenment is behind all of those changing experiences of the mind. There is this asankhata dhamma. There is this base experience, core experience. So the job of a yogi is to dampen down by any means possible this effervescent experience. And as it damps down, you start to get glimpses and you start to see where that asankhata dhamma, unconditioned, actually is. Now, for enlightened people, they will say that the sense of self jumps from all your self-identities into that. And you realize that that's your real self. So Ramana Maharshi, he said it was like a worm or a caterpillar. And I went to Ramana Maharshi's temple in Tiruvannamalai. Tiruvannamalai? That one. Around there, you can see on the trees, they have these little worms that inch around. And what the worms do is they stand on the leaf and they twirl around on the leaf of a tree like this. One end's gripped to the leaf and the other end twirling around. You can't tell which end is the head and which end is the base. And what they're doing is they're twirling around to see if they can grab onto something because they're blind. And if they, when they twirl around, they don't touch anything. They come down and they inch along another 6 inches. And then they stop and they go up for another twirl. It's quite pretty when you see them. It shows how boring it is staying in an ashram maybe, but there's not much else to do in an ashram in India. I was there in 1995. And it's really quite fun to see these very elegant little ballet dancers on the trees twirling around. And Ramana Maharshi said, what they're doing is they're twirling around to see if they can catch, you know, another leaf, another twig, another branch. If they catch a different leaf or twig or branch, they grab onto that new leaf and then the bottom end they let go of. And they come up and they've now moved on to a different leaf or a different branch. Fabulous metaphor. It's always really struck me, this thing. So Ramana Maharshi said this is exactly what you're doing. There is this unconditioned and that is your real home. But because you don't know where it is, you're twirling around in the air, blind. So, but every so often, you're going to latch onto it. Now, the mind will not let go of what it's holding onto until it has something new to grab onto instead, according to Ramana Maharshi. Remember I said earlier about models in Buddhism? This isn't a Buddhist model, but you can see it's hovering around the same idea. So before you let go of all these experiences, you're going to have to find something new to hold on to. That's the thing that's left over when everything has stopped. So a big part of the practice is to disenchant yourself with all this stuff that's going on. And you do the disenchantment by looking very closely, like going up to the cinema screen and seeing it's always white. Then, as you get disenchanted by it, and as you practice concentration, these two methods, concentration will slow things down, dampen things down, start to make gaps in your experience. And the mindfulness will give you wisdom. And the wisdom is that there's nothing here worth holding on to. As that happens, every so often, the mind just stops. As soon as that happens, you're like, that's it. Which of course is another thought and another experience, and then you've just lost it. But just for that brief moment, you've got that window, you've got that little indicator of where the practice is going to take you. Now, some people get this experience through drugs, happens. You know, I know quite a few people who have done that. For me, myself, I only took marijuana once in my lifetime, and that was because, you know, I'm not going to tell you that story. I've just thought better of it. I'll tell you privately, come and ask me privately why I did it. But what the end result was, I crashed my car. So I never took drugs again. It never really interested me. And I got into Dharma at quite an early age. But, you know, some people have done that through LSD and things like that. Got that glimpse. I know one guy, he was, he lived in the temple. I really liked this guy. He was a very straight, he's the kind of person that if you know him, he's just a great guy. But if you don't know him, he's probably robbing your house. So, you know, he had good qualities. I don't want to say someone's good or bad. Everybody has good or bad qualities, right? You know, I said to him, like, you're just not the kind of person to be in a monastery. When I squeezed him really hard, he came out with the story, and what had happened was he'd overdosed on drugs, on heroin actually. And as he almost died or had been clinically dead, as he recovered in hospital, as he came out of that almost death experience, he just had this really unshakable faith that there is something more to life, let's say, he put it like that. But he had an experience of this changing stuff, that's not it. And so he was in the monastery trying to find that. And you know, I tried to nail him down exactly what was the experience. You know, did like blue angels come to you and take you to heaven and show you something? But he would never let himself get nailed down. Something happened, some way or form, you pick up on this Asankata Dhamma, and that then it gives you these glimpses that there is something left over. There is something other than all of these experiences. So that's what we're doing when we do meditation, which we're going to do in a couple of minutes. Is there any question about what I've been talking about? I specifically decided to talk from the top rather than from the bottom. From the bottom, it'd be like, oh, the world's very stressful, come and do meditation, watch your breathing, isn't that peaceful? Let go, peace to all mankind. I mean, that's good and it's true and it's right, but if you've been doing it for a while, then actually these concepts of enlightenment, which are not in the usual Dharma talks, right? Actually, we need to play with these concepts. It gives us a clue and a hint of what it is that we're doing. Is there any question on this that I've talked about so far? Good. You're all obviously in the unconditioned right now. I know usually the Dharma talk is more interesting, gives you something to latch onto, but all the Dharma talks in all the world, by all the great speakers, could be the Dalai Lama up here, it's not going to help you unless you do the practice. The practice, we're going from these lofty concepts down to the actual experience of what it's like. I close my eyes, my mind gets sleepy. The aim is to be seeing the mind in this way, as one thing after another thing after another thing.